Thank you, John. And good afternoon, just about everybody. The last of our case studies concern the fluoridation of water, although we have some discussion about supplementation more generally. We picked this because it's a particularly interesting problem to deal with in terms of the difficulty of there being any clear default position. If we go ahead with adding fluoride to drinking water, we find ourselves in a situation where there will be undoubtedly a group of the community from the in which the water is fluoridated that doesn't want to drink fluoridated water. And in that sense, it's very hard to give them precisely what they want. But if we were to enable them to ensure none of the community receive fluoridated water, we'd be losing the opportunity to obtain a possible health benefit for a vulnerable group, mainly, but not exclusively, children. So it raised for us the fact that this is a situation which, if you like, it's not a clear win-win. So we had to grapple with how our framework, both in terms of the stewardship model and the intervention ladder, would apply to this area. So I want to take you through the conclusions that we reached. First of all, in terms of framing the problem that we're dealing with, it's clear that dental health varies, and it varies across the country in different areas, and it also varies across social groups. And you'll remember that one of our concerns was reducing health inequality. It's a place in which we already know that approximately 6 million people, about 10% of the UK population, already drink water containing fluoride, sometimes with fluoride added and sometimes in areas where fluoride occurs naturally. The argument for pursuing a fluoridation measure as a public health intervention is the expectation if we do so, we would reduce tooth decay. And I'll come back a little bit later on to some of the difficulties we found we had to grapple with in relation to uncertainty of evidence in relation to that and other aspects. And I should emphasize that as a working group, we've not attempted to make our own assessment of the strength of evidence. Much literature already exists around that. We've tried to grapple with what the appropriate ethical response is in areas where evidence is not entirely certain, although there is in place significant discussion of the range of evidence. And we also have a situation in which, as well as the expected benefits of fluoridation in terms of reducing tooth decay, there are also concerns about the possible adverse effects, in particular dental fluorosis. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. So we've got a context in which we have a need for an oral health strategy to address public health concerns, and some uncertainty about how that would fit into our conceptual framework. So what we did was we aimed to apply the ethical principles that we'd identified as part of the stewardship model. And starting off with the arguments that we'd put in place for fluoridating water, and then looking at the arguments which would count against the fluoridation of water. So the first obvious reason why we would consider fluoridation of water is the importance in the stewardship model of aiming to reduce the risk of ill health to our population. We already knew that we'd make various additions to our water supply to make water safe to drink, and we asked ourselves whether or not further health benefits could be created, reducing the risks of ill health by the addition of fluoride to water. And we felt that if that could be happened, it certainly put it in line with our stewardship framework as something that should be considered. We secondly looked at the argument that fluoridation of water supplies is a measure that, unlike many public health interventions, can reach everybody. And because of that, there's an expectation that it will make a contribution to reducing inequalities in health, because this was a measure that wouldn't enable people who were better informed, more able to get access to supplies that they might purchase, fluoridated toothpaste, supplements. This is something that would be expected to reach the whole population. And therefore, if that was sustained by the evidence, that would be an important reason for considering this as a valuable intervention on the stewardship model. And thirdly, we looked at the importance of protecting vulnerable groups, in this particular case, children. Children being a group more susceptible to tooth decay, dental caries, and also a group that has less ability to exercise independent choices from their family, from others around them, to secure the possibilities for improving their own health. All reasons why it seemed important to take seriously the case for fluoridating water supplies. But there are equally some important considerations to be weighed in the balance, which pushed the other way. We need to consider the significance of interventions without consent. We know in relation to traditional models of bioethics and individual treatments that it's very, very important to maintain the principle of autonomy in, as protected by not treating people without their consent. We're though in a problem with fluoridation, in that because it's a community-based intervention, if we were to pursue that in terms of enabling every individual to have a veto on what might happen to the community, then that would rob other members of the community of the possible health benefits. So we need to take very seriously the argument put forward by some of our respondents that fluoridation of water supply should be equated to forced medication. Although, as you'll see from the report, that's not the view that's taken by the appropriate regulators. The second part of our stewardship model we needed to look at very carefully is the importance of minimizing interventions that have an important impact on people's personal lives. So if we think about the fact that fluoridation of water leaves individuals with relatively small choice about whether they imbibe or not fluoride, important reason for treading very carefully in moving up the intervention ladder. If you like, it places it fairly high up on the intervention ladder. And the final principle that we discuss in relation to the application of our stewardship model is the principle that we should not coerce adults to lead healthy lives. But it's important to separate out that principle from one of the other arguments which is being picked up, and the main argument being picked up in the fluoridation debate, which is not actually an argument about telling adults how they should live for themselves, but balancing the choice of individuals against the benefits for other members of society. So the case that we look at in relation to support for fluoridation was not based on the idea that adults should drink fluoride because it was better for them, but on balancing the rights they should have to choose against the benefits for other people, other members of society. And we concluded that in order to strike an acceptable balance, we needed to think very carefully about the amount of freedom that would be sacrificed and the extents of benefits that would be secured if that freedom was sacrificed through the fluoridation of water. So we need to ask ourselves not so much whether or not this is about coercing adults to lead healthy lives as what are our mutual responsibilities in society to each other, a link with the question that Laura Finley asked us earlier on this morning. So turning to trying to make sense of those ethical issues, the first thing we found was that, judged by modern standards of scientific evidence, there's plenty of evidence around, but it's not of good quality, despite the fact that fluoridation has been used both in this country and worldwide for many decades. We, as many other people have done, spent a considerable amount of time discussing the meta-analysis carried out at the University of York, which looked overall, I think, at 3,200 papers dealing with fluoridation generally, and found surprisingly little convincing evidence to satisfy modern canons or peer review. In summary, and I need to come a little bit back to how this evidence is used shortly, our understanding of the York Review's findings, and we've checked this back with the team, was that they did find that there was evidence that fluoridation reduced dental caries, but the evidence was of poor quality and it was unclear how much it did so, making it very difficult to assess the benefits that would be achieved with any degree of precision. We also found from that York Review the discussion of studies that show a link between dental fluorosis, which is a coloration of the teeth, and I'm not an expert on this, there are others here there, which has varying degrees of significance, but in the York Review they identified 12.5% of cases where there would be cosmetic significance of fluorosis, although again the evidence was not thought to be of high quality. We also looked at a number of other really quite significant disease possibilities that were put forward to us by some respondents and in the literature opposed to fluoridation. And in the York Review summary, it was found that the evidence, again, was of poor quality, and there was no clear established association between fluoridation and those other harms. Now, I must emphasize, we've not sought here to review that evidence for ourselves. We've asked ourselves, how should policymakers handle that degree of uncertainty of evidence? The York Review indicated that on the best available evidence, it was accepted, the view should be taken that the best available evidence supported fluoridation, but found that it wasn't good quality evidence, and it was very hard to do a precise balancing of risks and benefits. We also looked at evidence on the change over time and noted that oral health has improved significantly across Europe, and there's a graph in the report taken from a recent publication in the British Medical Journal which demonstrates that oral health has improved across Europe, both in places where there is fluoride added either to water or to other substances, as well as places which are not fluoridated. And that's an important context in terms of framing how significant the potential health gain is and needs to be taken into account by policymakers. Our understanding of the York Review was, certainly to me, from what I heard previously, slightly surprising in relation to the arguments about health inequalities, where, as I indicated earlier, the plausibility of the case for fluoridation reducing health inequalities seemed quite high. But the York Review found that there wasn't clear-cut evidence to support the argument that we know for certain that fluoride, or certainly it can be that fluoride, would reduce health inequalities. We spent some time discussing one of the strong things said to us by respondents, that water is somehow special. And we found that wasn't a helpful analysis. We identified that we already did a number of things to water to make it safe to drink, and we didn't find that that helped us resolve the public health ethics challenges that we're dealing with. We did, however, have considerable discussions about the availability of alternatives, and you will see in the report a number of areas where different techniques are used to making fluoride available to people, including, perhaps most plausibly and widespread, the fluoridation of salt. And that led us to think in terms of how did this fit in terms of the intervention ladder, with fluoridation of water being seen to be higher up it than other supplementation. So, what did we conclude? Well, first of all, we took the view that there was no magic bullet that said fluoride can't be right. As a group, we were satisfied that if the evidence for health benefit was clear, and if there was no significant evidence of harm, then there will be a very strong case for the fluoridation of water supplies. So there's nothing in our view that automatically rules out this type of intervention as being too high up the intervention ladder. We would need, in order to decide whether to fluoridate in any particular case, to balance the risks and benefits, bearing in mind how difficult that is, given the difficulties of evidence. We'd need to look at the potential for taking less intrusive means to improve the dental health. And we need to look at how we fitted in this issue of balancing individual freedoms of some members of the community against the health benefits of others. We bore in mind that it was very important for policymakers to recognise that both fluoridating and not fluoridating has an impact on public health issues. So we didn't find the argument that there was an easy default position very powerful for us. We had to accept the responsibility for taking a decision one way or the other, and therefore we had to face up to that. And our solution was to recognise that the risks and benefits may be different in different parts of the country because of different degrees of oral ill health, as indicated earlier on in the presentation, that the discussion of whether alternative means could achieve the health benefits we needed would also vary from place to place. But also we need to take into account the fact that even though we can't see individual consent to drinking every glass of water, there is an important thing to balance in terms of interventions in individual freedom and choices. And our solution to that is that we would expect to see decisions about fluoridations tailored locally and determined through democratic decision-making process at a local level. So That led us to make some observations on, if we did have a democratic decision-making process, how would that relate to the concerns we have about evidence? I've already indicated that we recognise that deciding not to do something had to be justified as well as deciding to do it. We needed to bear in mind the need of people now as well as the importance of protecting people in the future, and for that reason thought it was inadequate simply to recommend more research. We did think that if fluoridation went ahead, it was important to monitor the effects of fluoridation and make that available, so that even if it wasn't done as part of a research study, we should enable improved and high-quality public debate in the future. But above all, we found that public debate was not well carried out in terms of the discussion of evidence. And we looked at a number of examples of misrepresentation in the views of the authors of the York Review of their findings, and felt it was very important that all groups concerned in the decision-making processes nationally and locally should take care to provide a balanced account of the scientific basis on risks and benefits. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.